Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Jerusalem. Approximately 935 B.C. Inside the royal palace sits the wisest man who ever lived, King Solomon, son of David, ruler of a united Israel at the height of its power and prosperity. He has everything. Unimaginable wealth. 700 wives, 300 concubines, a kingdom stretching from the Euphrates to Egypt. He built the temple of God with his own hands, a structure so magnificent that its glory would echo through millennia. And he's utterly miserable. This is the man who asked God for wisdom and received it in abundance. The king who could speak about plants from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop growing out of walls. Who could discourse on beasts, birds, reptiles, and fish. The monarch whose wisdom surpassed all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Kings and queens traveled from distant lands just to hear him speak. Yet, when he sits down to write near the end of his life, he produces what might be the most unsettling book in the entire Bible. A book so dark, so brutally honest, so apparently hopeless that rabbis debated whether it should even be included in the Hebrew scriptures. A book that sounds less like inspired scripture and more like the diary of a man having an existential crisis. This is Ecclesiastes. And if you've ever read it and thought, wait, is this really in the Bible? You're not alone. Because what you're about to discover is a wisdom tradition that most religious teachers conveniently skip over. The uncomfortable truths that challenge everything we're told about faith, purpose, and the meaning of life. But before we dive into the darkness, we need to understand who wrote this book and why. Because the identity of the preacher, the Qoheleth in Hebrew, is absolutely crucial to understanding the message. The book opens with a declaration. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Son of David, king in Jerusalem. The clues point directly to Solomon. But here's what's fascinating. Solomon never actually names himself in the book. He calls himself the preacher, the teacher, and the Qoheleth. This Hebrew word comes from kahal, meaning to assemble or gather. He's the one who gathers the assembly, who speaks to the congregation, and who convenes the people to teach them wisdom. But this isn't the young Solomon who prayed for wisdom at Gibeon. This isn't the Solomon who judged between two women claiming the same baby. This isn't even Solomon, at the height of his glory, dedicating the temple as tens of thousands of animals were sacrificed. This is old Solomon, broken Solomon. Solomon was at the end of his rope, looking back on a life that had everything and somehow ended up with nothing. The evidence is everywhere in the text. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Was king, past tense. He's writing from a place of reflection, of retrospection, of regret. He's describing his reign as something that's effectively over, even if he technically still sits on the throne. And what led him here? The very thing he asked for, wisdom. Remember that night at Gibeon? God appeared to Solomon in a dream and said, "Ask what I shall give thee." Solomon could have asked for anything. Long life, riches, the death of his enemies. Instead, he asked for wisdom to judge God's people. And God was so pleased with this request that he gave Solomon not only wisdom, but also riches and honor beyond measure. But wisdom comes with a terrible price. because the more you understand, the more you see. And the more you see, the more you realize how broken everything is. Let's start with the most shocking part, the word that appears over and over again throughout Ecclesiastes, vanity. But here's what they don't tell you in Sunday school. The Hebrew word isn't really vanity at all. The word is hevel, and it's far more disturbing than any English translation can capture. Hevel literally means breath or vapor. It's the mist you see when you exhale on a cold morning. It's here for a moment, then gone, utterly insubstantial, impossible to grasp, meaningless, empty, futile. The preacher uses this word 38 times in 12 short chapters. 38 times he tells us that everything is hevel, everything is vapor, everything is smoke. Your career? Hevel. Your wealth? Hevel. Your achievements? Hevel. Your legacy? Hevel. Even wisdom itself? You guessed it. Hevel. But it gets worse, because Solomon doesn't just use hevel as a standalone word. He pairs it with another phrase that appears throughout the book. Vexation of spirit, or in Hebrew, riut ruach. This literally means chasing after wind, or shepherding the wind, or even feeding on wind. Some translations render it as striving after wind. Think about that image for a moment. Imagine trying to catch the wind in your hands, trying to herd air like sheep, trying to eat breath. That's what Solomon says life amounts to. You spend your whole existence grasping at something you can never hold, chasing something you can never catch, and feeding on something that can never nourish you. So Solomon begins his grand experiment. Chapter 1 lays out his thesis. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. Generations come and go. You're born, you live, you die. Someone else is born. They live, they die. The earth keeps spinning. The sun rises and sets in an endless, meaningless cycle. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. There is no new thing under the sun. Every problem you face, someone else has faced before. Every solution you discover, someone else discovered millennia ago and then forgot. Every innovation is just a recombination of what already existed. History doesn't progress, it circles. Cycles. It repeats endlessly, like the wind that whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. This is Solomon's opening salvo, and it's devastating, because he's not wrong. From a purely earthly perspective, what does endure? You build a building, it crumbles. You write a book, it's forgotten. You have children, they die. You plant a garden, it withers. Everything you create, everything you accomplish, and everything you love will eventually be consumed by time. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Endless motion, endless activity, endless labor, and for what? The sea is never full, the eye is never satisfied with seeing, the ear is never filled with hearing, there's always more, always something missing, always a void that cannot be filled. But Solomon doesn't leave it at philosophical musings. In chapter 2, he gets personal. He describes his grand experiment to find meaning, and the methodology is breathtaking in its thoroughness. First, he tried pleasure. I said in mine heart, Go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. This wasn't casual indulgence. This was systematic hedonism. Solomon threw himself into every conceivable pleasure with the resources of an ancient superpower at his disposal. He built houses. Not just one palace, but multiple estates. He planted vineyards, made gardens and orchards, created pools of water to irrigate forests of growing trees. He bought male and female servants, had servants born in his house, possessed great herds and flocks, more than anyone in Jerusalem before him. He gathered silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. 1 Kings tells us that silver was as common as stones in Jerusalem during Solomon's reign. Ships brought him gold from Ophir, precious stones, and exotic woods. The Queen of Sheba came from the ends of the earth and was left breathless by his wealth. He got himself singers, both men and women, the delights of the sons of men. The Hebrew here is notoriously difficult to translate, but most scholars believe it refers to musical instruments, concubines, or both. The point is clear. Solomon denied himself nothing. Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. And what was the result? Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do. And behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. No profit, after all that. After experiencing pleasures that 99.9% of humanity could never even dream of, Solomon's verdict is crushing. It's all vapor. All chasing wind. Pleasure doesn't satisfy. It can't. Because the moment you attain one pleasure, you're already looking for the next one. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. But maybe Solomon just pursued the wrong kind of satisfaction. Maybe the problem wasn't seeking pleasure, but seeking the wrong pleasures. Maybe what he needed was something more intellectual, more noble, more worthy. So he tried wisdom. If anyone could find meaning through wisdom, it was Solomon. The man had wisdom as a divine gift. He could speak with authority on everything from botany to zoology. Kings came from distant lands to hear his wisdom. Surely, if anything could provide lasting meaning, it would be the pursuit and acquisition of knowledge and understanding. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Solomon became the ultimate researcher, the first scientist. He investigated everything, catalogued everything, analyzed everything. He applied the full force of his God-given wisdom to understanding the world. And his conclusion? For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. This is one of the most devastating verses in the entire Bible. Because what Solomon is saying is that wisdom, the very thing God gave him, the very thing that made him great, is actually a curse in disguise. The more you understand, the worse you feel. The more you know, the more you suffer. Why? Because wisdom opens your eyes to things you'd rather not see. It reveals the injustice baked into the system. It shows you the futility of human effort. It demonstrates how the same fate awaits both the wise and the foolish. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. This haunted Solomon. He was the wisest man who ever lived, and he would die exactly like the biggest fool. Both would be buried. Both would decay. Both would be forgotten. The annals of history might remember Solomon's name, but Solomon himself, his consciousness, his personality, his wisdom, all of it would end in the same dust as the village idiot. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. The wisest, richest, and most powerful king in Israel's history just said he hated life. Not that he was having a bad day, not that he was going through a difficult season. He hated life itself. Because when you truly understand how it works, when you see through all the illusions and comforting lies, what you find underneath is unbearable. But Solomon wasn't finished. He had one more avenue to explore. Maybe the problem with pleasure is that it's selfish. Maybe the problem with wisdom is that it's abstract. Maybe what gives life meaning is work, meaningful labor, creating something that lasts, building a legacy. So Solomon threw himself into work. We've already mentioned his building projects, but the scope was staggering. The temple took 7 years to build. His own palace took 13 years. He built the House of the Forest of Lebanon, the Hall of Pillars, the Hall of the Throne. He built Millo and repaired the breaches in the City of David. He built store cities, cities for his chariots and cities for his horsemen. He built in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and throughout all his dominions. Surely this would provide meaning. Surely creating monuments that would last for generations would give his life purpose. Surely building the very temple of God would be enough. But no. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor, wherein I have labored, and wherein I have shewed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Solomon built an empire, and he would have to leave it to someone else. All his wisdom, all his planning, all his careful construction, it would all be handed over to his successor. And he had no control over whether that person would be wise or foolish, competent or incompetent, faithful or faithless. History proved his fears justified. His son Rehoboam was a fool who split the kingdom in two through his arrogance and stupidity. Everything Solomon built the united monarchy. The prosperity, the peace, all of it came crashing down in a single generation. The 10 northern tribes rebelled and formed their own kingdom. Civil war, division. The beginning of the end. Solomon saw it coming. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. He gave up, despaired. Because what's the point of building anything if it's all going to be destroyed or mismanaged or forgotten? And this brings us to one of the darkest passages in all of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 3. You know this chapter. It's been quoted countless times, usually at weddings and funerals. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. It sounds beautiful, doesn't it? Poetic, meaningful. A reminder that life has rhythms and seasons and purposes, that everything happens for a reason, that there's a divine order to the universe. Except that's not what Solomon is saying at all. Look at the context. The famous "time for everything" passage is immediately followed by this: "What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth?" In other words, if everything has its predetermined time, if there's a season for every activity, then what's the point of your effort? You can't change the seasons. You can't alter the times. Things happen when they happen, and your labor makes no difference. Then Solomon drives the point home with even more disturbing observations. "I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath. So that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity." Let's be clear about what Solomon just said. Humans are no better than animals. We like to think we're special, that we're created in the image of God, and that we have souls and dignity and eternal significance. But from an empirical, observational standpoint, we're just smart animals. We breathe the same air. We eat and sleep and reproduce and die just like the beasts. And when we die, we go to the same place, the dust. All go unto one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? This is shocking. Solomon, the man who built the temple, who offered sacrifices, who knew the law of Moses, is openly questioning whether humans even have an afterlife that's different from animals. Who knows if our spirits go up while animal spirits go down? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Solomon genuinely doesn't know. And if there's no afterlife, or if we can't know whether there's an afterlife, then the logical conclusion is devastating. "Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die." If this life is all there is, if death is truly the end, if there's no ultimate justice or final accounting, then the only rational response is to squeeze whatever pleasure you can out of your brief existence before you return to dust. But Solomon isn't finished peeling back the layers of illusion. In chapter 4, he turns his attention to oppression and injustice in society. And what he observes drives him even deeper into despair. "So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Wherefore I praise the dead, which are already dead, more than the living, which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they, which hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." Read that carefully. Solomon is saying that the dead are better off than the living, but even better than both, those who were never born at all, those who never had to witness the evil and oppression and injustice that permeate human society. This is getting darker, much darker, because now Solomon isn't just talking about the futility of individual pursuits. He's talking about the structural evil of society itself. The oppressors have power. The oppressed have no one to comfort them. There's no justice, no rescue, no divine intervention to set things right, just power, dynamics, and suffering. And it gets worse. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbor. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. Even when you do good work, even when you achieve something genuinely worthwhile, what's the result? Your neighbor envies you. Your success breeds resentment. Your accomplishments make you a target. So what's the answer? Should you work hard or hardly work? The fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. The lazy person destroys themselves. But on the other hand, better is a handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. Better to have a little bit with peace than to have abundance with stress and striving. Solomon then observes the loneliness of ambition. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he hath neither child nor brother. Yet is there no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Neither saith he, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? This is also vanity, yea, it is a sore travail. The workaholic who has no one to share his wealth with, no family, no relationships, just endless labor for labor's sake. And even when he accumulates wealth, his eye is never satisfied. He never stops to ask the obvious question, who am I doing this for? He just keeps working, keeps striving, keeps chasing the wind, depriving himself of any actual enjoyment of life. Chapter 5 continues the assault on conventional wisdom. Solomon turns his attention to religious practices, and what he says is stunning in its cynicism. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. Don't make rash promises to God. Don't be quick to make vows. Why? For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by a multitude of words. When you make a vow to God and don't keep it, God isn't pleased. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. This is Solomon speaking from experience. He made vows. He built the temple. He offered sacrifices. He prayed public prayers. And then he turned around and married 700 foreign wives who turned his heart after other gods. He built high places for Chemosh and Molech. He did the very things God had explicitly forbidden. So his advice about religious devotion is tinged with bitter irony. Don't be too eager to make promises to God. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your vows few. Because you probably won't keep them anyway. And God isn't impressed by empty words. Then he addresses a question that has plagued humanity since the beginning. Why do the wicked prosper while the righteous suffer? If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Don't be surprised when you see injustice. Don't marvel at corruption. There's always someone higher up benefiting from the system. Bureaucracy protects bureaucracy. The powerful protect the powerful. This isn't a bug, it's a feature. And what about wealth? Surely accumulating riches provides some security, some meaning, and some lasting value. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is also vanity. The more you have, the more you want. There's never enough. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? You get richer, and suddenly you have more servants, more dependents, and more people with their hands out. Your expenses scale with your income. You don't actually get to enjoy the wealth, you just get to look at it. Meanwhile, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. The poor man sleeps soundly. The rich man lies awake worrying about his investments, his properties, and his security. Wealth doesn't buy peace. It buys anxiety. Then Solomon drops one of the most devastating observations in the entire book. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. Riches kept to their hurt. You spend your whole life accumulating wealth, and it ends up harming you. How? But those riches perish by evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. Market crashes, bad investments, theft, disaster. All the wealth you spent decades building can vanish in an instant. And then you have nothing to leave your children. As he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. You were born naked. You'll die naked. Everything in between is just temporary possession. You own nothing. You're just borrowing it for a few decades before you have to give it all back. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? You work your whole life, and in the end, you have nothing to show for it. You were chasing wind, trying to grasp vapor, and now you're dead and it's all gone. Chapter 6 continues the relentless assault on every possible source of meaning. Solomon describes a man whom God gives wealth, riches, and honor, everything his heart desires. But God doesn't give him the power to enjoy it. Instead, a stranger consumes it. If a man beget 100 children, and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. A man could have 100 children and live for centuries, but if his soul isn't satisfied with good, if life brings no joy, then he'd be better off as a stillborn child. At least the stillborn child never had to experience the futility and disappointment of existence. For he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. The stillborn child has more rest, more peace, because it never had to strive and struggle and suffer and then die anyway. It skipped straight to the end without having to endure the meaningless middle. This is among the darkest passages in all of Scripture. Solomon is saying that non-existence is preferable to a life without satisfaction, that oblivion is better than futility, that it would be better never to have been born than to live a long life devoid of genuine joy. Yea, though he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath he seen no good. Do not all go to one place. Even if you lived for 2,000 years, If those years brought no satisfaction, what's the point? You still end up in the same place as everyone else, the grave. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. Everything you work for is just to feed yourself, and even then you're never satisfied. You eat today, and you're hungry again tomorrow. There's no end to it, no lasting satisfaction, just an endless cycle of need and temporary fulfillment and need again. And what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? What's the point of wisdom if you end up in the same place as the fool? What's the benefit of being poor but righteous if you end up just as dead as the rich and wicked? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. It's better to enjoy what you have than to constantly crave what you don't have. But even that is vapor. Even contentment is chasing wind. Then Solomon makes a statement that cuts to the heart of the entire book. That which hath been is named already, and it is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. You are what you are. You're human, you're finite, you're mortal, and you can't argue with the one who is mightier than you. You can't negotiate with God. You can't change the fundamental conditions of your existence. You're stuck with the hand you've been dealt. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity, what is man the better? The more words you speak, the more vanity you create. The more you try to explain, or justify, or understand, the more futile it all becomes. So what's the point? For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? Nobody knows what's truly good. Nobody knows what will happen tomorrow. Your life is a shadow here for a moment, then gone, and you have no idea what the future holds. Chapter 7 shifts slightly. Solomon starts offering practical wisdom, proverbs, and observations about how to navigate this meaningless existence. But even his practical advice is tinged with darkness. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. The day you die is better than the day you were born. Why? Because at least when you're dead, the suffering is over. At least you don't have to endure any more futility. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Go to funerals, not parties. Why? Because funerals remind you that you're going to die. They force you to confront reality. Parties are just escapism, temporary distractions from the inevitable. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Sorrow is better than laughter. Wise people think about death. Fools distract themselves with entertainment. This is Solomon's advice for living well. Meditate on mortality. Embrace sadness. Face the darkness. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Solomon then returns to his search for wisdom and understanding. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise. But it was far from me. that which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? True wisdom is unreachable. The deep things, the meaning of life, the purposes of God, the reasons for suffering, they're all beyond human comprehension. You can chase wisdom your whole life and never catch it. I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. Solomon investigated everything, wisdom and folly, righteousness and wickedness, sanity and madness. He left no stone unturned in his quest to understand reality. And what did he find? And I find more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. This passage has troubled interpreters for centuries. Is Solomon being misogynistic? Is he referring to a specific woman, perhaps one of his many wives who led him astray? Or is he speaking metaphorically about seductive folly? The context suggests he's talking about temptation personified, the trap that looks appealing but leads to destruction. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one, to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Out of a thousand people, Solomon found maybe one person of integrity, one person worth trusting. Everyone else? Compromised, corrupt, unreliable, and this discovery was devastating. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. God made humanity good, upright, righteous, but we've corrupted ourselves with our clever schemes and inventions and rationalizations. We've created complexity where God intended simplicity. We've built systems of oppression where God intended justice. Chapter 8 continues wrestling with the problem of injustice and divine providence. Solomon observes that wisdom gives you some advantage. It makes your face shine. It tempers harsh judgments. But ultimately, you're still subject to powers beyond your control. Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. There's a right time for everything, a moment of judgment for every action. But here's the problem. For he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? You don't know when that time will come. You don't know when judgment will fall. So you live in constant uncertainty, never knowing if today is the day your actions will catch up with you. There is no man that hath power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit. Neither hath he power in the day of death, and there is no discharge in that war. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. Death is the great equalizer. You can't control when it comes. You can't avoid it through wickedness or righteousness. There's no discharge from that war. Everyone fights it. Everyone loses. Then comes one of the most troubling passages in the entire book. All this have I seen, and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. And so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. The wicked are buried with honor. They're forgotten just like everyone else. Their wickedness doesn't prevent them from receiving a respectable funeral and being laid to rest like everyone else. Where's the justice in that? Because a sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. This is a profound psychological insight. When punishment is delayed, when consequences don't immediately follow wrongdoing, people become emboldened in their evil. They think they can get away with it. And often, they do. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God. Here Solomon seems to contradict himself. He says he knows it will be well with those who fear God and badly for the wicked. But then he immediately undercuts this certainty. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. Sometimes righteous people get what the wicked deserve. Sometimes wicked people get what the righteous deserve. The moral universe isn't balanced. Justice isn't automatic. Bad things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. And there's no explanation for it. It's just vapor, just wind. So what's Solomon's conclusion after observing all this injustice? Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. For that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. Eat, drink, and be merry. Again, it's the refrain that keeps appearing throughout Ecclesiastes. Not because Solomon believes this is the ultimate answer, but because from a purely earthly perspective, what else is there? If justice doesn't prevail, if the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, if everyone ends up in the same grave regardless of their choices, then why not at least enjoy the simple pleasures while you can? When I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. The ultimate conclusion of Solomon's investigation, you cannot figure it out. No matter how hard you try, no matter how wise you are, no matter how much you study and analyze and investigate, you will never fully understand God's work. The meaning behind it all remains hidden. Chapter 9 opens with an observation that is simultaneously comforting and terrifying. For all this, I considered in my heart even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them. Everything is in God's hands. That's the comforting part. The terrifying part? You can't tell from external circumstances whether God loves you or hates you. The same things happen to everyone. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth, as he that feareth an oath. The same fate awaits everyone, righteous or wicked, clean or unclean, religious or irreligious. It doesn't matter. You all end up dead. This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. Human hearts are full of evil and madness. We live crazy, corrupted lives, and then we die. That's it. That's the pattern. But then, Solomon offers a glimmer of hope, or at least a pragmatic reason, to prefer life over death. For to him that is joined to all the living there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. A living dog is better than a dead lion. As long as you're alive, there's hope. It might be false hope, it might be irrational hope, but it's something. Death offers nothing. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion for ever in anything that is done under the sun. The dead know nothing. They have no knowledge, no reward, and no memory. They don't love or hate or envy. They have no stake in anything that happens in the world. They're just gone. So again, Solomon's advice: go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun, all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Enjoy life while you can. Eat and drink. Wear clean clothes. Use perfume. Love your wife. These are your portion. This is what you get. Don't expect anything more. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Do what you can while you can, because once you're dead, it's over. No second chances, no continuation, just the grave. Then Solomon makes another devastating observation about the randomness of life. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all. This might be the most important verse in the entire book. The race doesn't always go to the fastest. The battle doesn't always go to the strongest. The wise don't always prosper. The intelligent don't always get rich. The skilled don't always find favor. Why? Because time and chance happen to everyone. Luck, random chance, being in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. You can do everything right and still lose. You can do everything wrong and still win. There's no guarantee, no cosmic justice ensuring that the deserving prosper and the undeserving fail. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare. So are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. You don't know when disaster will strike. Like a fish caught in a net or a bird in a snare, you can be going about your business one moment and trapped the next. Death, disaster, and catastrophe, they come suddenly, without warning, without regard for whether you deserve them or not. The rest of chapter 9 and into chapter 10, Solomon offers various proverbs and observations about wisdom and folly. But even these are tinged with futility. Wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Even if you're wise, if you're poor, nobody listens to you. Your wisdom is worthless because you lack status. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. One mistake can destroy a reputation built over years. All it takes is one dead fly to ruin the entire batch of perfume. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. The wise person's inclination leads them right. The fool's inclination leads them wrong. But both are still just following their hearts, their nature. Can the fool help being a fool any more than the wise can help being wise? If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. If someone in power gets angry with you, don't quit. Stay calm. Appease them. This is practical advice for surviving in a corrupt system, but it's hardly inspiring. It's accommodation to injustice. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. The world is upside down. Fools are promoted to positions of power. The capable are relegated to low positions. The social order makes no sense. Merit doesn't determine success. Solomon then offers a series of proverbs about work, speech, and conduct. But even these contain dark undercurrents. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. Every activity contains danger. Every job has risks. You can't escape hazard. Life is inherently dangerous. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Work smart, not just hard. But even wisdom can't eliminate the need for effort, for struggle, for exhaustion. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Some things happen regardless of whether you're wise or foolish. The snake bites, the gossip talks. You can't control everything. Then, in chapter 11, Solomon shifts to offering advice about risk and prudence. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Take risks. Invest. You might get a return eventually. Or you might not. But you have to try. Give a portion to 7, and also to 8, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Diversify, spread your bets, because you don't know what disaster might come. You don't know which investments will pay off. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. Things happen according to natural law. The rain falls, the tree falls, and wherever it falls, that's where it lies. Accept reality as it is. He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. If you wait for perfect conditions, you'll never act, you'll never plant, you'll never harvest. Sometimes you have to move forward despite uncertainty. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child. Even so, thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. You don't understand how life begins. You don't understand how God works. Accept your ignorance and move forward anyway. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. Keep working. Keep trying. You don't know what will succeed. Maybe everything will fail. Maybe something will work. But you won't know unless you try. Then Solomon addresses the young. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Enjoy your youth. Follow your heart. Pursue your desires. But remember, there will be an accounting. God will judge. This is the first clear reference to divine judgment in the entire book. Solomon has spent 11 chapters describing a world where justice doesn't prevail, where the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, and where random chance determines outcomes. And now, suddenly, he mentions judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart, and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Youth is vapor. It's fleeting. It passes like smoke. Enjoy it while you have it, because it won't last. Chapter 12 opens with one of the most beautiful and haunting passages in all of literature. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Remember God while you're young, before old age arrives, before the years come when you have no pleasure in life. Then Solomon paints a vivid, poetic picture of old age and decline. While the sun, or the light, or the moon, or the stars, be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. This is describing the fading of vitality, the dimming of perception, and the declining faculties of old age. In the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease, because they are few, and those that look out of the windows be darkened. The keepers of the house, your arms and hands tremble. The strong men, your legs bow and weaken. The grinders, your teeth cease, because they're few. Those who look out the windows, your eyes grow dark. And the doors shall be shut in the streets when the sound of the grinding is low. And he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. Your hearing fails. You wake at the slightest sound. You can't appreciate music anymore. Also, when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fears shall be in the way, and the almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail. You fear heights. You're afraid to travel. Your hair turns white like almond blossoms. The smallest burden feels overwhelming. Sexual desire fails. Because man goeth to his long home, and the mourners go about the streets, or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. Death approaches. The body breaks down like a broken pitcher, a severed cord, or a shattered bowl. The machinery of life stops functioning. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Finally, death. The body returns to dust. The spirit returns to God. It's over. And then Solomon repeats the opening refrain. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. After 12 chapters of investigation, experimentation, observation, and reflection, Solomon returns to where he started. Everything is vapor, everything is breath, everything is futile. But this isn't quite the end. There's an epilogue, a conclusion, and it changes everything. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he yet taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and sought out, and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The preacher was wise, he taught, he organized proverbs, he sought truth. This entire book, as dark as it is, was an attempt to find and convey truth. The words of the wise are as goads, and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. Wise words are like goads. They prod you, make you uncomfortable, and push you forward. They're like nails. They pin things down, secure them, and make them stable. And they come from one shepherd, God himself. Then comes a warning. And further, by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. You can study forever, read endless books, pursue endless knowledge, and it will wear you out, exhaust you, and you still won't have all the answers. So, after all of that, after 12 chapters of relentless pessimism, after systematically demolishing every possible source of earthly meaning, after acknowledging the futility and injustice and randomness of life, Solomon gives us the conclusion. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment, with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. This is it. This is the answer. After trying everything else, pleasure, wisdom, work, wealth, power, legacy, after finding all of it empty and futile, Solomon lands on the only thing that remains. Fear God. Keep his commandments. Not because it guarantees prosperity. Not because it ensures justice in this life. Not because it makes everything make sense. But because it's the whole duty of man. It's what we were created for. It's the only response that acknowledges our place in the universe. Finite creatures before an infinite creator. And notice what else Solomon says. God will bring every work into judgment, including secret things. This is crucial, because it addresses the central problem that haunted the entire book, the apparent lack of justice, the wicked prospering, the righteous suffering, the randomness of outcomes. Solomon's answer? The accounting isn't settled yet. Justice isn't complete. There will be a final judgment where every deed, every word, and every secret thought will be evaluated. Nothing will be overlooked. Nothing will be forgotten. The wicked who prospered won't escape. The righteous who suffered won't be ignored. This is why Ecclesiastes sounds so dark. Because it's supposed to. Because Solomon is systematically destroying every false foundation, every temporary comfort, every earthly prop we lean on for meaning. He's showing us that if we try to find ultimate meaning under the sun, within the closed system of earthly existence, we will end up exactly where he did, staring into the abyss of futility. But the book doesn't end in the abyss. It ends with a choice, a narrow path, a single response that makes sense when you've eliminated all the alternatives. Fear God. Keep his commandments. Wait for judgment. That's the wisdom they don't teach. The uncomfortable acknowledgement that life really is futile when evaluated purely on earthly terms. That death really does win every earthly battle. That justice really doesn't always prevail in this life. That random chance really does determine many outcomes. Ecclesiastes refuses to sugarcoat any of this. It won't let you hide behind comfortable platitudes or false optimism. It forces you to confront reality in all its harshness and absurdity. And only then, after you've truly grasped how meaningless everything under the sun is, does it offer you the way out. Not an escape from reality, not a denial of the darkness, but a reframing, a perspective from above the sun, an acknowledgement that there is more than this, that eternity is set in our hearts for a reason, that God placed it there to draw us beyond the temporal, beyond the futile, beyond the vapor. This is why the rabbis almost didn't include Ecclesiastes in the Hebrew Bible. It's dangerous. It's subversive. It questions everything. It offers no easy answers. It provides no comfortable assurances. It just stares unflinchingly at reality and reports what it sees. But it's also profoundly honest. And that honesty is precisely what makes the conclusion so powerful. Because Solomon didn't arrive at fear God and keep his commandments through wishful thinking or blind faith, he arrived there through exhaustive investigation, through trying every alternative, through eliminating every other possibility. He tried pleasure and found it empty. He pursued wisdom and found it increased sorrow. He threw himself into work and found it all had to be left to someone else. He accumulated wealth and found it brought no satisfaction. He observed society and found injustice everywhere. He studied nature and found only cycles with no progress. He contemplated death and found it made everything equal. And after all of that, after genuinely wrestling with the futility and meaninglessness of existence under the sun, he makes a choice. Not because it's easy. Not because it solves all the problems. Not because it makes everything make sense. But because it's what remains when everything else has been eliminated. This is the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. Not seven simple steps to a better life. Not positive thinking or prosperity promises, but brutal, unflinching honesty about the human condition, about our limitations, about our mortality, about the futility of trying to find ultimate meaning in temporary things. And then, against that dark backdrop, a single candle, a narrow path, a choice to believe anyway. To fear God anyway, to keep his commandments anyway. Not because we've figured everything out. Not because justice always prevails. Not because life makes sense. But because eternity is set in our hearts, we cannot help but reach for something beyond the vapor. That's why Ecclesiastes sounds so dark. Because it tells the truth about life under the sun. And the truth is harsh and uncomfortable and deeply unsettling, but it's also liberating. Because once you've faced the darkness honestly, once you've acknowledged the futility without flinching, you're free to make an authentic choice about what to build your life upon. Not religion as escapism, not faith as wishful thinking, but genuine, clear-eyed commitment to the one foundation that remains when all the false foundations have crumbled: fear of God, obedience to His commandments, trust that the judgment is coming and justice will ultimately prevail. This is the book they're afraid to teach, the wisdom that makes people uncomfortable, the truth that doesn't fit neatly into Sunday school lessons or inspirational sermons. Because Ecclesiastes doesn't tell you that everything happens for a reason, or that God has a wonderful plan for your life, or that if you just believe hard enough, all your problems will disappear. Instead, it says, life is hard, often unfair, ultimately futile when evaluated on purely earthly terms. You're going to die. Everything you build will crumble. Everyone you love will be forgotten. Justice won't always prevail. Random chance will determine many of your outcomes, and there's nothing you can do about any of it. And then it says, fear God anyway. Keep His commandments anyway. Because that's your purpose. That's why you were created. And one day, everything will be brought into judgment, and the accounts will be settled, and justice will finally, finally prevail. That's Ecclesiastes. That's the wisdom they don't teach, and that's why it still sounds so dark 3,000 years later. Because it's still telling the truth.